This is broadcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off this week. Today's broadcast was originally recorded on June 4th, 2025.
There are mass murderers in the world. Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, Stalin. We don't have anybody on the list from America. But by taking away that agency and being at least semi-responsible for the deaths of probably by the end of this hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, that's Elon Musk's legacy.
Oh, well, congratulations, Elon. You're now compared to Pol Pot and Stalin.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Ain't you proud?
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world. Blanketing planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. I don't know if I have ever quoted the New York Times so-called conservative, so-called David Brooks on this program before. Des, have I ever cited David Brooks?
No, you have not.
At least not positively.
Correct.
On this show. So forgive me for doing so here because he finally got something right. On the PBS NewsHour, I believe this was, last week, he tried in his David Brooksian way to put an important point out there that with all of the madness of King Donald every day and his drug-addled neo-Nazi sidekick Elon Musk sort of sucking up all the oxygen and damn near every news cycle, with all of that going on every day, I was happy to see Brooks actually get these numbers out. You heard a little bit of this at the top of the show right there. I was happy to hear him get these numbers out, even a little bit, on the PBS NewsHour last week, if anybody still watches that. It came, I believe, as part of Elon's supposed exit from the federal government last week when people were discussing his legacy. Really, it was his retreat from the White House to try his pretend retreat from the White House
right.
to try and save himself and his companies from disaster, if possible, after the past year of Musk revealing who he really is to the world and the world not liking it much. And so Brooks picked up on what, at least I hope, is in fact someday tied to the legacy of Elon Musk, to who he actually is or was. You'll recall one of the very first things that he ordered his Doge bros to do upon Trump taking office was the complete takeover and shutdown of the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, which has for decades now played a critical role around the globe in helping to, you know, feed starving people, including children, and has kept tens of millions of men, women, and children around the globe alive with the distribution of life-saving medicines and vaccines courtesy of the United States. You're welcome. It also helped prevent the spread of deadly diseases to this country in the bargain, while winning the hearts and minds for the United States around the world. All of that, at least, until Trump gave the go-ahead, apparently, to Elon Musk and the Doge bros to shut it all down. That was about 4 months ago, but the damage, the carnage, the body count in those four short months, well, that is what David Brooks took note of on Friday's PBS NewsHour.
Folks at Boston University who count, how many people have died because of what Doge did at USAID? According to the Boston University folks, so far 55,000 adults have died of AIDS in the 4 months since Trump was elected. 6,000 children are dead because of what Doge did. That's just PEPFAR, the HIV. You add them all up, that's 300,000 dead, and we're 4 months in. Now you accumulate that over 4 years, the number of dead grows very high. There are mass murderers in the world, Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, Stalin. We don't have anybody on the list for America. And I don't think it's the same as committing the kind of genocide they did. But by taking away that agency and being at least semi-responsible for the deaths of probably by the end of this hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, that's Elon Musk's legacy. And the people who work at Tesla and SpaceX might want to think about that.
Yeah, they might. Thank you, David Brooks. A legacy for Elon Musk, equating him on any level, frankly, to Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, Stalin. Well, I'm sure supporters of Musk and Trump, who allowed all of this to happen, they could not be prouder, right? And that's David Brooks pointing that out. But those numbers from Boston University, well, they were put together, as all of this came apart, by Associate Professor Dr. Brooke Nichols, who, I think it's fair to say, was just about as horrified as anyone when she compiled her own data and saw what it was spelling out. Data that is now available to all of us, thankfully, at the ImpactCounter.com website, documenting, if nothing else, for history, the global carnage right now, underway. Thanks to Elon Musk and the Trump administration and all of those who support them and applauded their efforts to shut down USAID, or as Elon Musk said, feed it into a wood chipper. Anyway, more on that in a moment, as we are joined by Dr. Brooke Nichols to discuss her project and those horrors. In some lighter news, perhaps, with the deaths that have already come around the world with the shutdown of USAID and its approximately $50 billion budget, imagine how much fun we're now going to have here in the U.S. if Republicans and the Trump administration go ahead with their plan to slash about $1 trillion in funding to healthcare and food assistance for Americans via cuts to Medicaid and SNAP in their so-called big, beautiful bill that has already passed in the House and is now moving through the Senate, where Republicans hope to have it all as a done deal by the July 4th recess. It would, by many estimates, result in the loss of healthcare coverage for as many as 14 million here in the U.S. Not around the world if you don't care about those folks, but here in the U.S. But the illness, the death, the carnage that will come as a result of those cuts to food and health care, well, that's not what has Republicans worried in the Senate about this bill. They would like to see more cuts to help pay for the $4 trillion in tax cuts, mostly to wealthy Americans and huge corporations, because, as they pretend, they are worried about deficit spending to cover the costs of those huge tax cuts to their rich friends. Are they talking about lowering those huge tax cuts? No, not really. Are they talking about finding other ways, cutting perhaps the Defense Department to lower that deficit spending? No, not really. They're talking about, cutting more health care for more Americans. On Wednesday, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, came out with their assessment of the Trump Republicans' so-called Big Beautiful Bill, wrapping up Trump's entire legislative agenda into one big horrible piece of legislation. And the CBO score for that bill was not to the liking of Republicans for some reason. President Donald Trump's big bill in Congress, as AP reports, would unleash trillions in tax cuts and slash spending, but also spike deficits by $2.4 trillion over the decade and leave nearly 11 million people without health insurance. As noted, other organizations on both the right and the left have pegged both of those numbers, the deficit spending and the loss of health care, a little bit higher. But this is coming from Congress's own nonpartisan organization created 50 years ago by Congress, run by Congress, so that they could assure that they were receiving nonpartisan advice in the scoring of their legislative projects. As AP explains, the work of the CBO, which for decades has served as the official scorekeeper of legislation in Congress, is closely watched by lawmakers and others seeking to understand the budgetary impacts of the sprawling 1,000-page-plus bill, along with $3.75 trillion to extend Trump's 2017 tax breaks and add new ones to it. The CBO found that the package would reduce federal spending outlays by $1.3 trillion, largely through proposed reductions to Medicaid and rollbacks of green energy initiatives.
Great. Just what we needed.
So it's going to cut that. It's not like it's going to, you know, spend everything. Well, it all goes to the tax cuts, of course. And while 10.9 million people would no longer have health insurance with changes to Medicaid, the CBO has previously estimated that nearly 4 million fewer people would have access to food stamps each month due to the legislation's proposed changes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP.
Yeah, tax cuts for the rich, taken out of the hides of low-income Americans.
Ahead of the CBO's release in a preemptive campaign, so this is before the numbers came out, in a preemptive campaign, because they knew what was coming, to sow doubt in the findings from the CBO, the White House and Republican leaders began criticizing the nonpartisan budget office as a hotbed of lefty Democratic communists or something. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt suggested that the CBO's nearly 300 employees, they're all biased, even though, as AP notes, budget office workers face strict ethical rules to ensure objectivity and impartiality. In fact, as Leavitt, House Speaker Mike Johnson, and other Republicans argue, this bill would actually save trillions of dollars somehow. It won't increase the deficit, I guess, even though the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says otherwise. But that's only because they're partisan, the CBO. Leavitt offered the proof for that claim at the White House on Tuesday, again, before the CBO numbers came out for some reason.
I don't think many people know this. There hasn't been a single staffer in the entire Congressional Budget Office that has contributed to a Republican since the year 2000. But guess what? There have been many staffers within the Congressional Budget Office who have contributed to Democrat candidates and politicians every single cycle since. So unfortunately, this is an institution in our country that has become partisan and political, and we are very confident in our own economic analyses of this bill. There is $1.6 trillion in savings.
Okay, Democrat candidates. But it sounds bad. Not a single staffer has donated to Republicans. Just money to Democrats, hand over fist, cycle after cycle after cycle. Now, while Karoline Leavitt lies like she breathes and is, by the way, very accomplished at it. I don't mean to undercut her work.
She's
very good.
Yeah,
she's very good.
World class.
A world class liar. And so we usually don't bother to fact check her nonsense here because there is just so much of it. We wouldn't be able to do anything else. But here, since actual lives are on the line here, and since the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office used to be nonpartisan just a few months ago, back when Republicans would use their scoring of legislation under Joe Biden in order to oppose Joe Biden's legislation, and since an attack on the CBO is now pretty much apparently all they have left here, it does seem worth just taking a moment to look at Karoline Leavitt's lie on this particular issue. Thankfully, we've got the Washington Post's excellent fact checker, Glenn Kessler, to help us out on this today. He describes Leavitt's White House attack on the CBO as, quote, veering into ridiculousness. Never mind, he notes, the similar conclusions about the big, beautiful bill that have been reached about the deficit spending in that bill from the right and the left, from organizations including the Tax Foundation, the Penn Wharton Budget Model. Penn Wharton, isn't that where Donald Trump went to school? The Manhattan Institute, the Center for American Progress, on both the right and the left. As the official scorekeeper for Congress, the CBO has clout, he notes. So the White House decided to attack the messenger. When asked about Leavitt's claim, a White House official defended that claim as, quote, a verifiable fact. And she provided a link to Federal Election Commission records showing 250 contributions since 2000 made by people who listed the CBO as their employer. Kessler notes, but there are also stupid facts, and this one is remarkably dumb. He says the records show that, yes, all of the contributions were made to Democrats or Democratic-leaning causes like gay rights. But upon studying the list, we discovered that many of those donations were made by the same people. Going back to 2015, when Trump first entered the political scene, we counted 210 contributions, mostly for $10 or $20 or smaller, by just 16 people. Going all the way back to 2000, that only added 8 more people. But the CBO employs about 275 people, and of course there is a lot of churn, so hundreds of people would have worked at the agency since 2015, let alone since 2000. He says this is scarcely a representative pool of CBO employees over those 25 years. So he says he checked the background of each of those 16 people who made contributions since 2015. Many have since moved on to other jobs, retired, or even died. Most held relatively low-level positions at the CBO, unlikely to be involved in a major budget analysis like this one. Moreover, only 3 people. So now we're down to 3 people, 2 editors and an agricultural analyst, made donations in the 2024 cycle at all. The people, none of them budget analysts who would have been working on this scoring. Of those 3, the biggest donation was for Vice President Kamala Harris for $100, and the rest were donations under $30 to congressional candidates or to Harris for $25. So 3 people. But nonetheless, Leavitt stood before the White House press corps and declared that, quote, many staffers had donated to Democrats and decried this to show that the CBO had become, quote, partisan and political. But then, by the way, there's the part she forgot to mention, and that is that the director of the CBO, I guess he's not considered a staffer because he's a director, runs the organization. The CBO director, Philip Swagel, served in the George W. Bush administration. Campaign records show that he donated $1,000 to a Republican candidate for governor in 2014. And yes, he heads up the joint. Moreover, the CBO director is chosen by the House and Senate budget committees. So in 2019, he was chosen for a 4-year term by then-Senator Mike Enzi, Republican of Wyoming. And then he was reappointed in 2023 when he was recommended by Jody Arrington, the Republican from Texas. Under its hiring process, CBO does not consider political affiliation, saying it, quote, seeks to hire the best qualified job candidate solely on the basis of his or her fitness to perform the duties of the position. The agency also places limitations on employees' political activities and their public advocacy. So, says Kessler, what the White House calls a verifiable fact is, in fact, a nonsense fact delivered in service of a false claim about all of this. The FEC list of contributions does not demonstrate that the agency run by a Republican has turned, quote, partisan and political on behalf of Democrats. Instead, it shows a handful of low-level employees made some small contributions to Democrats while being led by a Republican who made at least one large contribution to a Republican, none of which demonstrates the larger point that was made by Leavitt. Kessler adds the White House apparently thought it was clever to go back 25 years. He says, but let's not forget, before 2011, Donald Trump donated more to Democrats than Republicans. He says that's a verifiable fact, too, but we would not claim it means very much today. Levitt is awarded by the fact checker at the Washington Post 4 out of 4 possible Pinocchios for her lie.
Good.
All of these lies by all of these Trumpers might actually be amusing if, in fact, they didn't turn out to be so deadly. If anywhere from 10 to 14 million Americans were not about to lose their health care if this big, ugly bill is actually adopted into law. And if the administration's shutdown of foreign aid had not already killed more than 300,000 people across the globe, with millions more set to die in the years ahead because of it, with the shutdown of USAID, unless something is done to change the current trajectory. Dr. Brooke Nichols of Boston University, who put together those horrifying USAID numbers, she joins us next to discuss them. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. So way back in mid-March, which seems forever ago now, but it was just about 2.5 months ago, Elon Musk and his Doge bros were still amid their initial tear through the federal government, shutting down agencies willy-nilly, canceling contracts about which they had no clue what they were actually for, claiming all of it was little more than putting an end to massive federal government waste, fraud, and abuse, and otherwise denying that any of it had an effect on anyone other than the fraudsters who had been massively ripping off U.S. taxpayers for years. Among the Doge bros' very first trophies was the complete shutdown of the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, as you may recall, which manages the bulk of the nation's foreign aid around the world. And while Republicans have long claimed that, and their voters have long believed, that foreign aid amounts to a huge chunk of the federal budget, with polls revealing that most voters would like to see that amount lowered to something more like 10% or so, in fact, U.S. foreign aid amounts to less than 1% of our annual budget as is. And that was before the Doge bros went on their tear. But as U.S. foreign aid experts explain, that tiny percent of our budget punches way above its weight in the projection of soft power by the U.S. around the globe, winning hearts and minds, particularly in developing nations, where the U.S. would like very much to avoid the use of hard military power to combat unstable regimes amid poverty, starvation, and, yes, mass illness. At least that used to be the position of the U.S. under both Democratic and Republican administrations alike. Healthy populations abroad, as it turns out, also help prevent infectious diseases from making their way to our shores. Not that we have any recent experience with that sort of thing in this country, right? At the time that the so-called Department of Government Efficiency was canceling contracts and literally shutting down the USAID headquarters in D.C., literally using a chisel to remove these steel letters embedded into the front of the building, and as aid workers around the world were attempting to sound the alarm for the damage being caused already around the world, with food for starving children literally rotting in warehouses and medicine to control epidemics of AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, Ebola, sitting on shelves but not being distributed to where it remains much needed. Lead Doge bro Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, adamantly declared, quote, "No one has died as a result of a brief pause to do a sanity check on foreign aid funding." Repeating for emphasis, no one. But as journalist Nicholas Kristof, after traveling to several of the countries most affected by the shutdown of USAID, reported in a gut-wrenching 2,700-word report for the New York Times, that was not true. In South Sudan, one of the world's poorest countries, Kristof wrote, the efforts by Musk and President Trump were already leading children to die. One story Kristof reported on 2.5 months ago was that of Peter Dondi, a 10-year-old infected with HIV from his mother during childbirth. But American aid had kept Peter strong and his parents died from AIDS. A program started by President George W. Bush called PEPFAR saved 26 million lives from AIDS, and one, in fact, was Peter's. Under PEPFAR, an outreach health worker ensured that Peter and other AIDS orphans got their medicines. And then, in January, Trump and Musk effectively shuttered USAID. And that program, PEPFAR, well, it ended. Orphans were on their own. Without the help of the community health worker, Peter was unable to get his medicine, so he became sick, and he died in late February. The immediate cause of death was an opportunistic pneumonia infection as Peter's viral load increased and his immunity diminished, said the outreach worker who had helped manage care for Peter and almost 150 other vulnerable children, adding, quote, if USAID would be here, Peter Dondi would not have died. Akol Dang, an 8-year-old girl, was also infected with HIV at birth and likewise remained alive because of American assistance. And then in January, well, she lost her ID card and there was no longer a caseworker to help get her a new card and medicines. So yes, she too became sick and died. Another household kept alive by American aid was that of Jennifer Inya, a 35-year-old single mom, and her 5-year-old son, Evan Anzu, both of them HIV positive. In February, after the aid shut down, Inya became sick, and she died. And a week later, Evan died as well, according to a community health worker who assisted them. Decisions by billionaires in Washington quickly cost the lives of a mother and her son, noted Kristof. Quote, many more children will die in the coming weeks, said Margaret Mjuma, a health worker who confirmed the deaths of Peter and Akol. On Kristof's 9-day trip through East African villages and slums, he said he heard that refrain repeatedly. While some were already dying because of the decisions in Washington, the toll was likely to soar in the coming months as stockpiles of medicine and food were drawn down and as people became weaker and sicker. Kristof's report described how he worked with experts at the Center for Global Development at the time to try and track how many more deaths would occur over this next year alone due to lack of AIDS prevention medicine and vaccines and food assistance with the shuttering of USAID. The number at the time, which we reported on the show, seemed astounding. As the experts argued, a cataclysm may be beginning around the developing world with an estimated 1.6 million people who could die within a year without foreign aid for HIV prevention and treatment. He says that he worked with experts at the Center for Global Development with this calculation to try to figure out how many people were in fact at risk. An estimated 500,000 people could die within a year without American funding for vaccines, according to the modeling. 550,000 people could die within a year without American funding for food aid. 290,000 could die within a year without American funding for malaria prevention. 310,000 people could die within a year without U.S. funding for tuberculosis prevention. That After Elon Musk had celebrated his shutdown of USAID by declaring on social media that he had spent the weekend after Trump's inauguration, quote, feeding USAID into the wood chipper. And apparently, about 300,000 people around the world so far into that chipper, it seems. Last week, on Friday, Josie Ensor of the Times of London reported that when Brooke Nichols plugged in the data, she could not comprehend what she was seeing. Nichols, a mathematician and professor of infectious diseases at Boston University, had created a model to predict the human cost of the DOGE USAID funding cuts. What Nichols had not appreciated was what was killing people and just how quickly it appeared to be doing so. A death tracked back to the shutdown of USAID was estimated to be happening somewhere in the world every 3 minutes. As Elon Musk arrived at the White House last Friday for his, we'll call it a victory lap, before supposedly leaving the federal government, President Trump congratulated him for his work slashing the federal budget as the number of deaths on Nichols' tracker hit 300,000. With more than 200,000 of them children. At Nichols' ImpactCounter.com website, where we can all watch these numbers tick up in horrifying real time, the main dashboard documents 103 deaths per hour around the world, now occurring thanks to the termination of dozens of life-saving programs that have been ended or, as Musk said, paused by the Trump administration. Adult deaths, more than 100,000. Deaths of children, as of an hour or so before airtime today, more than 212,000 and increasing each minute around the world from not just HIV, but tuberculosis, malnutrition, pneumonia, diarrhea. All of this happening right now under our watch. Quote, these are 100% preventable deaths, Nichols told The Times. They all happened because of the abrupt halt in funding. Joining us now is Brooke Nichols, creator of the ImpactCounter.com website that, while receiving some attention in recent days, has not received the attention that I think it should, given what it is tracking, who is responsible for the carnage that it documents, and how easy it might be to put an immediate stop to the ever-increasing, horrifying numbers that the site details. Brooke Nichols is an infectious disease mathematical modeler and health economist and an associate professor of global health at Boston University, where her research seeks to minimize the health and economic impact of infectious diseases through innovative quantitative approaches. Based in the Netherlands, Dr. Nichols leads an international research team of scientists and modelers who integrate insights from clinical science, epidemiology, health economics, and mathematical modeling to develop actionable evidence-based strategies. Dr. Brooke Nichols, thanks for staying up late out there for us, and welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
So
happy to stay up late for this.
I really appreciate it. I really do. Before we dive into some of these numbers and what they mean and what, if anything, can or should or will be done about them, what is an infectious disease mathematical modeler and health economist? And how did that set you on this path toward creating this work that is only now just beginning to get the attention, at least in this country, that I think it warrants?
Yeah. So what is an infectious disease mathematical modeler?
Yep.
So basically what we try to do is to understand, to simplify the world around us, mm-hmm. to be able to understand disease dynamics. So whether or not if we do one thing, you know, if it's a vaccine or a new diagnostic or a new treatment, what's the effect going to be without having to actually, let's say, run a trial itself. So mm-hmm. we can play around within the model to understand the effect of one thing on the entire disease transmission chain. Mm-hmm. And the health economics part of that is a lot of it's around, well, what's cost effective? How do we cost effectively implement different things? And so we're always looking for efficiencies. Mm-hmm. We want to implement things that are the most cost effective because we know that resources are scarce. There's not enough money to do all the things we need to do. So we need to be really clear and careful about what we choose to do.
I'm guessing with COVID over the last few years, you have been very busy, only now to run into this. The Times of London reports that you were horrified by your own numbers when you plugged them in to this model regarding USAID. What surprised you about your own data initially? And did you think your numbers were wrong when you saw them?
I was horrified because they represent people. And I think when I put all of the different categories of, you know, tuberculosis and the different child health, all of these together in one place, mm-hmm. to actually see what number that looked like altogether, I really was shocked because I've worked most of my life, most of my career was focused on HIV, at least the first 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. And so I had had a gut feeling that HIV would certainly be sort of the biggest number. Mm-hmm. But doing all of this work, the deaths related to malnutrition, pneumonia, diarrhea amongst children, that was clear, and huge numbers. And I think the greatest, these numbers are out there with some degree of certainty, right? They're on a website, it's a number, mm-hmm. but it's important to know that of course there are uncertainties. And I think the things that we don't understand right now is what's still happening, even though the funding has been cut off. Mm-hmm. So, but there's no way that we can find out, you know, are these programs still running? Yes or no? Have country governments picked up the tab somehow, or have people volunteered their time? And in a lot of cases, people are doing that and gaps are getting filled, but not everywhere. And I really think what these numbers mean and what they show us is this gap in funding relates to this number of deaths, because that is what that funding mm-hmm. was accounting for, was providing resources for.
And to be clear, the more than 300,000 deaths that I noted in the intro is cited by the Times of London and others from your tracker, more than 212 as of right now of them right now being children. That's not an estimate for the coming year. Those are estimates of deaths that have happened already just since the shutdown of USAID in early February, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. So that's to date, all right? And then, that number will grow to close to 1 million by the end of the year if funding isn't restored in some way. When we do modeling, of course, there's a lot of different equations and distributions and all these things. And it's really difficult to kind of boil that down into a single number that mm-hmm. people can really feel and understand.
Yeah.
And so what we've done here is really look at, well, what would a full year of impact be with this gap in funding? And then saying, okay, well, if we divide the total impact across the year, so this mm-hmm. is really just sort of a straight line, what we call a straight line projection. And so it could be that in the early days, as you were saying in your introduction, that as children, as adults start to weaken from these different diseases, that, and then as stockpiles run out of these different medications, that all of a sudden the deaths might look to us with the naked eye to not be as big as this counter shows, but they will very quickly increase exponentially. Mm. And that's what I'm worried about as well.
What is your response to those who claim that all of this was, you know, simply about ending massive waste, fraud, and abuse in the USAID program? What's your response there? Noting that we're on FCC radio in your response, so be careful.
Oh, right. Language. noted. I cannot... So even if, let's say, USAID was their only purpose was soft power, is that so bad? And along the line to also be saving millions of people's lives and doing the right thing, what? I'm not quite sure what the massive fraud, waste, and abuse looks like. Mm-hmm. I know USAID is exceptionally good at tracking, doing monitoring and evaluation, using analyses like the things that I do to make things more cost effective, to make sure that every dollar that is spent in an effective way. I mean, I haven't seen programs run like this, honestly, before. And were there small bits and pieces of things that could have been programmed differently or better or improved outcomes? Maybe, but I'm sure that that is a tiny fraction of the budget and certainly not worth throwing anything into the wood chipper and losing all these tens of thousands of lives.
For much of your career, as you know, you've been working on HIV, the PEPFAR program, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, initially begun during the George W. Bush administration. Tell us about that program, its successes, and what has now come of it since the Trump-Musk-Doge destruction began. Because, you know, Marco Rubio, senator, former senator from Florida, now Secretary of State, he claims that, the important programs, apparently PEPFAR, I guess, being one of them, they won't have a pause. They'll just be brought over to the State Department. They'll be run over from there. What is PEPFAR, and is that true? Is that actually happening? Has it been continuing out of the State Department?
Oh, PEPFAR was one heck of a impressive program that really, I mean, back in the early 2000s, people were dying left, right, and center. Hospitals were completely overwhelmed, overflowing with people dying of AIDS. People were going to at funerals every weekend. I mean, it was just unimaginable. And through PEPFAR, a complete turnaround, right? Once especially we started to get treatment and really effective treatment to people, all of a sudden people stopped dying. Hospitals aren't full of people dying of AIDS. It is remarkable. And we are finally getting to the point where we're reaching all of these UNAIDS goals for testing and treatment and being successfully on treatment, let's say. Uh-huh. And if you're on treatment and you take your pills every day, you can't transmit the virus. How cool is that? So we kind of started to reach this tipping point where the epidemic was going down. It's more and more under control. We're hitting these targets. And to just have the carpet pulled out from under us, right? Like as we get so close, it pulls like the progress. Yeah. It just sets us back a decade. I mean, horrific. And is it still running? Well, USAID was, I mean, there's a lot of contracts that had been canceled that were related to PEPFAR. Mm-hmm. I heard Marco Rubio say 85% of PEPFAR is running. I'm not sure exactly what is or isn't running, to be honest. I know that the drugs are the antiretroviral treatment to treat people with HIV. Uh-huh. Those are still being procured, to my knowledge, but I still know a lot of staff members have been laid off. A lot of programs have been canceled. And if you can't get the drugs to the people because you don't have the staff, well, does it count? I'm not sure.
Well, are you seeing evidence that, you know, where PEPFAR, where at least our contribution to the program is falling off, that other nations, other international aid groups are able to fill those gaps being left behind? Are they adjusting, in other words, after that initial, you know, disaster that I mentioned that Nicholas Kristof documented back in mid-March? Have you seen a change in the way those programs are being administered with other countries jumping in to fill the gap?
So I work in just a few countries, so I can't speak for many, but you did see sort of the early days was really quite chaotic. Uh-huh. And I think some of the programs are back up and running to some degree, but there are still massive gaps. And the things that USAID would fund, it's not like, you know, they funded exactly half of everything and it was, you know, you throw away half the program and half of it saved. It's more difficult because they'll fund parts of the healthcare system, and you kind of take away that connective tissue and that infrastructure. That's like playing Jenga, right? Like, which is the piece that's going to make everything collapse. But of course, you know, countries don't want to see their own citizens die. They don't want to see backtracking of progress. And so of course, people out of the goodness of their heart and with what little budgets they do have are making a plan because people are awesome. At least some people are awesome. But in terms of like broad sweeping, like certain organizations or other people stepping in, I think it's much more piecemeal. than that.
And are those, when there are changes to the program, when funding is either restarted in this country or others fill the gap, is your model at impactmodel.com, is that continuously being updated and the numbers recalculated based on new information as we move forward?
So this is something I would like to do. Right now, the HIV numbers are pretty much reflective of that. If what Rubio says is true, and if 85% of PEPFAR is running again, the numbers that are here roughly reflect what that would look like over the course of a year. So that's still fine. For the other numbers, I would like to update as, you know, as I get information from people, or if there's very clear documentation of something being online, I would love to include it and update these accordingly, because I'm not out here to overestimate anything, right? Like, I want to understand what the impact is and make it as clear as I can to people. And so I've already had one person actually reach out today about malaria, saying that they do have good stocks of malaria medication. And so maybe these deaths haven't started happening yet, but that they will fall off a cliff at the end of 2025, because there's no plan for filling in the budget. So perhaps that's something I need to update, and I have reached out and we're now in conversation to figure out exactly what this means, and I will absolutely update it. You know, I'm not here to fear monger or to put extra blame, right? I'm a one-woman show, basically, and an unfunded project with my friend who's been behind the scenes very nicely working on the website for me. Thank you, Eric. Well, it's a big task.
Thank Eric, especially because it's really easy to understand these numbers. A lot of websites I'm often, you know, pointed to with details, scientific details, real hard to make mere human beings like me to make sense of. This one is very clear, very stark, and very understandable. Did you expect, Brooke Nichols, any of this when Trump was running for another term? In other words, did you pick up any reporting or comments from his rallies and so forth that suggested he would be shutting these life-saving programs just down, that USAID would be just closed? Did you get any sense of that? Were you concerned about that? Did you hear anything at his rallies, promises made, that led you to expect this is where we would all be going?
No. What the swear words? No, right? Like I was shocked, right? Because I mean, when they first announced the aid freeze, I thought, well, certainly they don't mean, you know, PEPFAR, and certainly they don't mean these programs that actually keep people alive.
Yeah.
And no, they meant all of that too, and I was shocked because this has had bipartisan support for forever, so. No, I did not see this coming, to be honest. Maybe I should have, but I mean, lots of things were said, and there's so much, right? There's so many things that are said, so many actions that are done. It's a pure chaos storm, so it's hard to know. And yeah, did not see this coming.
In 2023, USAID's entire budget was just about $40 billion, which on its own might seem like a lot, but with the massive, you know, multi-trillion dollar annual U.S. budget, really, it's just a drop in the bucket. And yet, polls suggest most Americans think that foreign aid is a much larger chunk of the federal budget. I realize you're not a political scientist, but as in the as in the climate realm, which we cover a lot on this show, a lot of the scientists over the years we've talked to have realized, okay, they can't just be climate scientists. They also have to sort of become communication experts and get into the political game to a certain extent. Do you have any sense of how we must change our political system to make it clearer to Americans, as you see it, how important, above and beyond the horrific, devastating numbers that you're detailing, how can we get the point across about the importance of this sort of aid to not only our standing in our world and our ability to prevent, you know, political collapse and the spread of epidemics abroad, but what it means to us back home and the horrors that can, you know, come back to our shores. Is there a way to approach this issue that we are not doing that might be more helpful for folks like yourself?
I really think it's the depolarization of the country, right? Like that now if we associate USAID and global health and aid with being left, and that means bad, then it must all be bad and the worst, right? Instead of under, you know, but when you dig down and ask people what they care about, then people are decent. Americans are decent. And if you ask them about any of these individual things, of course that, you know, these seem like the right things that we should be doing with our budget. And I've had a lot of really good, like amazing people reach out from the interfaith communities and pastors and various different people across the country, through the middle of the country, you know, not just the coast, reaching out and, you know, appreciating that someone is trying to look at this and they want to do something about it as well. Like they find this important, they want to elevate it. And I think trying to have these conversations in just a, not a political way, but in a really like level, what is this? What does it mean? Why should we do it or not do it? How can we do it different? You know, if people can engage with it and not just be screaming at each other about it, I think we get so much further.
One of the things that's kind of remarkable to me is that, you know, I quipped about it earlier, but we're just coming out of a years-long pandemic. You would think that people, that would lead people to understand the dangers of, you know, what's going on around the rest of the world, that it's not just here, but we need to worry about what's going on elsewhere making its way back here. Can you speak to what these programs and the laws of these programs, how they endanger Americans here in the U.S.?
Absolutely. I mean, so infectious diseases don't know borders, and they will indeed, you know, if we see an increase in burden of infectious diseases globally, that will almost certainly have an effect in the United States. I mean, it's not going to be you know, night and day, and all of a sudden we have a massive HIV epidemic. We already have a pretty substantial HIV epidemic, and this would potentially increase cases a bit if there's a lot more people living with HIV and aren't treated around the world, for example. Malaria, we won't necessarily see, we need mosquitoes for malaria. But USAID was also funding all kinds of different programs like surveillance and identifying new pathogens. I think that's something we want to keep doing if we don't want, I don't know, an Ebola outbreak in America, because Ebola doesn't care where it is. It cares that it has a host. It can replicate. And so it absolutely should be of concern to Americans.
And it's fair to say that when it is, when we cut off funding to Ebola treatment abroad, that that makes us more vulnerable to it back here?
100%. And also, no one wants to, you know, play with us in the sandpit. If, you know, if push comes to shove and there is an outbreak of something, and collaborating with the US now feels like, well, we've broken trust with a lot of countries, a lot of other organizations. So who would want to immediately share information with us? Who would want to share, you know, specimens and samples? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And it definitely puts us in a vulnerable position.
Are you getting a lot of attention from the media? I saw that David Brooks, a guy who I, you know, almost never in my life would be quoting, was citing your numbers over the weekend. I saw reports in from the Times, the Times of London, New York Times, and so forth. Are you getting the media, the attention from the media that you think all of this deserves?
So I think when I first was working on this, we were hoping that it would get out there, and not quite sure what I thought that would mean. Just so that people, you know, understand what the numbers look like and what the damage that could be done. Especially, we really were hoping that the website would be used in the early days to say, okay, well, let's turn the funding back on now, because look at how many people we could save by if we turn the funding back on. And it's sort of taken a life of its own from then. But ever since Bono cited these numbers on a Joe Rogan interview, then I got a lot of different kind of attention, mostly death threats and hate mail.
Really?
Oh yeah. And not an insignificant quantity.
Hate mail for documenting what is going on and people dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's,
you know, we only hate some facts, not all facts.
I guess so. Wow, that's remarkable. Finally, Brooke Nichols, what do you hope that your work, as you continue to model this ongoing horror at impactmodel.com, what do you hope that it will ultimately accomplish, and has it done so? Has it begun to do so?
Yeah, I really hope that it can be used to understand, document what's happening, but also hopefully to advocate for change, to either fill these gaps, either through the U.S. government, through other governments, so that we know where we're at and we know what we need. If we know that people are going to be dying of, you know, these three causes, and we can redirect resources there, you know, ultimately I want this to be used so fewer people die. And if that's through people understanding what's happening in a political shift, that would be great. If it's for mobilizing other donors, that's also great. So any of that.
Well, Brooke Nichols, thank you for your critical work. I hope it receives more and more attention and the action, frankly, that it warrants. Thanks for staying up late with us out there in the Netherlands to join us to explain it. I hope you don't mind if we ring you up again in the near future as things move forward. Brooke Nichols is an infectious disease mathematical modeler and health economist and associate professor of global health at Boston University. You can find her, as I said, critical work at impactcounter.com. And you can follow her on the blue skies at Brooke E. Nichols. Brooke Nichols, really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Brad. Appreciate it.
You bet. All right, we have got to get out.
Yes, but I will say her goal of having fewer people die, that is definitely a worthy goal.
Laudable. Brother, thanks. Anyway, thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or want to give it another listen or share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can do so anytime for free via bradblog.com. That is made possible, by the way, by those of you who stop, take 30 seconds, hit a donate button, and help us continue the work we try to do over your public airwaves. It's much appreciated and, yes, much needed. You can go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, I am the Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.